Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th Canto, Chapter 2, The Elephant Gajendra's Crisis, Text 20. So we'll read about 10 verses, because it's not a purport until Text 30. Tathai kadatad giri kananashraya.
Tathai kadatad giri kananashraya.
Kare nubir varana yuta pascharan. Sakantakam kichaka venu vetravad.
Sakantakam kichaka venu vetravad.
Vishalagumang prarujan vanaspatin. Tatraikada tad giri kananashraya. Karenubhir varana yuta pascharan. Sakantakam kichaka venu vetravat. Vishala gomang parujan vanaspati.
Hare
Krishna. So, there are many texts giving a vivid description of Gajendra's party, his attempts to enjoy on Trikuta Mountain. The leader of the elephants, who lived in the forest of the mountain Trikuta, once wandered toward the lake with his female elephants. He broke many plants, creepers, thickets, and trees, not caring for their piercing thorns. Simply by catching scent of that elephant, all the other elephants, the tigers, and other ferocious animals, such as lions, rhinoceroses, great serpents, and black and white sarabas, fled in fear. The Chamari deer also fled. By the mercy of this elephant, animals like foxes, wolves, buffaloes, bears, boars, gopuchas, porcupines, monkeys, rabbits, and other deer, and many other small animals loitered elsewhere in the forest. They were not afraid of him. Oh, we get a little purport here. All the animals were practically controlled by this elephant. Yet although they could move without fear, because of respect, they did not stand before him. I'll read a few other verses. Surrounded by the herds, other elephants, including females, and followed by the young ones, Gajapati, the leader of the elephants, made Trikuta Mountain tremble all around because of the weight of his body. He was perspiring. Liquor dripped from his mouth. And his vision was overwhelmed by intoxication. He was being served by bumblebees who drank honey. And from a distance, he could smell the dust of the lotus flowers, which was carried from the lake by the breeze. Thus surrounded by his associates, who were afflicted by thirst, he soon arrived at the bank of the lake. The king of the elephants entered the lake, bathed thoroughly, and was relieved of his fatigue. Then, with the aid of his trunk, he drank the cold, clear nectarian water, which was mixed with the dust of lotus flowers and water lilies, until he was fully satisfied. Like a human being who lacks spiritual knowledge and is too attached to family members, the elephant, being illusioned by the external energy of Krishna, had his wives and children bathe and drink the water. Indeed, he raised water from the lake with his trunk and sprayed it over them. He did not mind the hard labor involved in this endeavor.
Stop there. Oh, my God, it's an understrecker, and it's an understrecker, it's actually Tommy, and it's my shooting him out.
The scene is the heavenly planets. You've heard about Trikuta Mountain, which is a resort place for the demigods. And Prabhupada is asserting throughout the beginning of this chapter that you can't deny the accounts being given by Shukadeva Goswami just because you've never experienced such things. Prabhupada's point is that there's so much about the earth you don't know about. Your own planet. You haven't gone to the depths of the ocean. You haven't been on top of every mountain. What to speak of? Are you able to see other dimensions which are outside the human perception? In other words, even in the same apparent physical space, other dimensions may occupy that space, and these dimensions you may not be able to see. So in this way, Prabhupada pushes back our blind faith that we know everything about the world because our mundane authorities have given us knowledge. This chapter in Srimad Bhagavatam has nothing to do with what you're being taught in school about the universe. No one in school is teaching you about the ocean of milk. The ocean of milk surrounds Trikuta Mountain. And when the ocean of milk washes upon the shore, it produces emeralds. And the demigods play in the ocean of milk, and the wives of the demigods add fragrance to the ocean, the lakes, rivers, and air, because their bodies are so fragrant. Do we have any ladies like that on the earth planet? That when they go to the beach or the pond or the lake or the forest, they add fragrance to those places? This is not a description of the spiritual world. This is a description of the material world, the heavenly planets. You can use some common sense and logic to understand that even on this earth planet, there are places which are considered very nice and places which are considered not very nice to live in. If you go to Bali, just a few hours above Perth, everything is very nice. The people are very content there. Not much anxiety. In fact, Borjan Prabhu was telling me. His wife has been there, and she picked up that the residents of Bali, they have no anxieties. They just have one desire, that they take birth in Bali again in their next life. Plenty of tropical fruits. The living is easy. There's no cold there, and the beach is there, and everything is nice and slow paced. And then there are other places on this earth where you wouldn't want to live at all. Sudan or Somalia or Ethiopia, countries like that. North Korea. It was even rumored during the famine in North Korea a few years ago that people were eating children. So, you can see even on this earth planet that there are different levels. So why cannot that be true about the entire universe? Just because you've only experienced the ocean of salt water doesn't mean there can't be oceans of something else. But notice the tendency of the materialistic mind. As soon as you hear something that's outside your range of experience, you reject it. No, that can't be so. Mythology. Why is it that what Shukadeva Goswami speaks is mythology, and what bewildered, sinful scientists speak is the absolute truth? Why is that? Whatever so-called knowledge you learn in school, it changes every 100 years, even less. The scientific knowledge of now is quite different from the scientific knowledge of the beginning of the century. Sukadeva Goswami is speaking the same thing that has been handed down millennia after millennia. The details vary, but the basic knowledge is the same. So here you're getting a description of the heavenly plans, where the standard of sense gratification is thousands of times more intense than what's available on Earth. So just like the residents of Earth like to go to vacation spots, similarly, the demigods also go to their vacation spots. But the quality of the demigods' vacation spots is far superior. And the demigods themselves are far superior. Therefore, as we said, when the wise of the demigods are sporting in the lakes and rivers and forests, their bodies add fragrance to those places. We get a very exhaustive description of Trikuta Mountain, its three principal peaks made of iron, gold, and silver, respectively. By hearing these descriptions, you get your understanding of the universe expanded. Otherwise, the natural tendency is to think every planet, if there is life, is probably like Earth, or inferior to Earth, or a little bit better than Earth. But here we see that the heavenly planets are on a totally different level. Even still, the beauty of the heavenly planets cannot compare to Krishna's Vrindavan. And the beauty of the heavenly planets, ladies, cannot compare to Krishna's cowherd girl consorts. So in this way, we can see how our consciousness is expanded from the earthly level to the heavenly planets level, and then the Bhagavatam will take you to the spiritual level, the level of Krishna's own personal abode. And each time, your conceptions of what is beauty and pleasure are overturned. When you go from the earth level to the heavenly planets, that's a totally different standard of beauty and pleasure. But it doesn't end there. When you go from the heavenly planets to Krishna's abode, then the standard of beauty and pleasure goes into still another dimension. So this is what the Bhagavatam is doing for us. It is giving us a complete vision of the material and spiritual world. Now, even though we're on the heavenly planets in this description, hearing about Trikuta Mountain, still you can recognize some basic things which exist everywhere in the material world. What are those basic things? The desire for sense gratification, the presence of some impediments, and eventually we're going to hear about reactions. We're being introduced to the leader of the elephants, Gajendra, or Gajapati. Gajapati means lord of the elephants. Gajendra means king of the elephants. He lives in this area, and he's surrounded with his female elephants and entourage. What does the Bhagavatam say in second canto? Deha patra kalacha adishu atma sanyesha satsupi tesham pramato nidanam pashyanapi na pashyati. The conditioned soul thinks, I'm surrounded by my family, my friends, society. I'll be protected. I'm safe. Tesham pramata nidanam pashyanapi na pashyati. This has happened again and again. We have enough experience of it. This is called history. The attempt of the conditioned soul to surround himself or herself with family, friends, and society and think, they'll protect me. This is my private army. I'll be shielded from the blows of material nature by my private army of family and friends and society. It's like here in Australia. Everyone has their mates. Do the ladies call each other mates? No. What do the ladies call each other? I'm just friends. Friends. Right. So you have your mates and you have your friends. And then you have your families. For however long a material Australian family lasts. And then you have society. And of course, the society gives you the Dole and Oz study and all sorts of things like that. So you feel very safe. You've got your fallible soldiers around you. You feel secure. Friends, mates, family, and society, Dole. I'm all right. What does Shukadeva Goswami say? Pashyanta pina pashyati. You don't see, although you're sufficiently experienced. In other words, Shukadeva Goswami is saying that just because you're experienced doesn't mean you can see what's going on. People tend to think that if I get experience, then I'll understand, then I'll see. Just like the adults look down on the children. Oh, you don't have enough experience, you'll find out. But have the adults obtained any real vision? No. But the assumption is there that as you get older, you acquire insight because of experience. You acquire more profound vision. But Shukadeva Goswami disagrees. He says, Pashyanta pina pashyati. Although you're sufficiently experienced, still you do not see what's going on. I remember talking to Donna's father, and now Krishna consciousness, yeah, it's all right. I mean, anything that my daughter is doing like this has got to be better than what she was doing before, so let it be. She just needs more experience. You know, he felt he was an experienced man, trying to establish a family, and in time, he hoped that his daughter would also mature through experience and in that way be a genuine member of society. So the assumption is there in such apparently respectable adults. When our children go through their rebellious stage and get it all out of their system, they'll settle down to be experienced, solid citizens. Due to the force of circumstance, many parents are prepared these days to allow their children to go through a wild time, the teenage years or in their 20s. They figure, well, that's just a part of life, rites of passage. These things are going to happen these days. Rather than the parents admit they don't know how to raise children, rather than the parents admit they're totally bewildered, instead, they cop out by saying, well, it's natural that our children will go through this heavy rebellious stage and do wild things. That's just the way it is. To some extent, that is true. Part of the psychophysical nature of teenagers is that they go through a rebellious stage. But it doesn't have to be as abominable as it is now. Yet, although it's so abominable now, the parents stand back. Oh, yes. This is just part of their growing up. It's happening with all the children, so therefore, it'll be all right in some, in, you know, 10 years or so. They're hoping that their children will be the better because of the experience. But Shukadeva Goswami says, just because you're experienced doesn't mean that you have vision, that you can understand. You ought to understand because you are sufficiently experienced, not only in this life, but so many lives. Still, you do not see the impending destruction. Pashyanapi na pashyati. Tesham pramato nidhanam. Pashyanapi na pashyati. You would feel very terrible in this world if you had no friends, no family, and no government to support you. You feel terrible. That's a good thing about when you travel to foreign countries. It's like Dave and Adrian have been on this trip with me. So they can see what it's like to be in a place where you don't know many people. Of course, wherever we went, there were devotees. But just imagine, you're plopped in the middle of a strange place, don't know anyone, can't speak the language, you really feel exposed. Where's your army of fallible soldiers? You don't have them. Where are your friends? Where's your family? Where's your favorable government? Some of the countries we go to, you don't want the government to protect you. The so-called protection of the government is pretty bad. It's like, I know one country in South America, Bolivia. Okay, let's say your house gets robbed at night. You don't want to call the police. Why? The police will come, and whatever the robbers didn't take, the police will take. Oh, you called us? You've been burglarized? Oh, what else is left? So if people have been burgled, they just, well, that's the way it is. They never call the police. It's like jumping from the frying pan into the fire. So it's interesting to feel life as it is without the army of fallible soldiers. It's like when you go to India. Of course, you feel secure when you go to India because there's so many devotees. But if you ever wandered around India and in places where there's no temples and you didn't know anybody, you really feel vulnerable. That's the word. You really feel vulnerable. I guess Edward had a taste that when he lost his, when he had his passport and money stolen. Yes, all of a sudden, you know, where's my American passport? My protection. Where's my money? My protection. Where's my airline ticket? How do I get out of here? Everything gone. Whether he went to take a shower and he put his valuables, nearby, and when he came out of the shower, gone. So immediately, he was bewildered. I don't know what to do. So you understand how we psychologically wrap ourselves in these various shrouds in the material world to feel secure. That is normal. That's the normal psychological tendency of conditioned soul. But Shukadeva Goswami, he has his job of pointing out how we do these illusory things. Now in this chapter, Shukadeva Goswami is describing the heavenly planets, and Gajapati, Gajendra, he's got his own group of fallible soldiers. They're elephants, especially female elephants. So he's wandering towards a lake, and on the way, he's breaking many plants, creepers, thickets, and trees, not caring for their piercing thorns. Why? Why doesn't he care? He's got a goal in mind. He's got a vision. Sense gratification is waiting for me. Never mind the temporary pain of some thorns. I've got something real up ahead. Similarly, in material life, people don't mind little austerities as long as they can go for that goal. Yes, so what if you have to work under humiliating conditions? So what if you're pushed around and bossed around at your job? At the end, you'll get that paycheck. It'll make it all worthwhile. Or sometimes people think, be your own boss. Go into business for yourself. That'll solve all the problems. But to be your own boss and have your own business still means you must submit to so many anxieties. You've got to placate so many people while being your own boss. And then you go to your home and your family takes all your money. Then you don't like your family. But should you get a divorce? Very expensive. You'll lose at least half your home, half your assets. What to do? Well, just better have a list of affairs. Better be an adulterer than get a divorce. Why, you could lose everything through a divorce. All this goes on in the name of being your own boss. There's no doubt there are inconveniences in this world. But because you have sense gratification in your mind, you don't see the inconveniences, or you ignore them. It's all right. It's all right. There's something good up ahead. You go to the university. You have hopes. I'm going to get knowledge. Or at least if I don't get knowledge, I'll get something that will help me make more money in the future. Some certification. And you go through so many austerities. Sitting in classes, taking exams. But you've got that vision in mind. We're speaking materially. Of course, our devotees work. Our devotees have businesses. Our devotees go to university. But they're doing these things in order to maintain their ashram so they can have a foundation for performing spiritual life. So it's different. They don't take these things to be the all in all. It's like they take it to be like just like taking a shower in the morning. You know, these are things you have to do. How many of you take a shower in the morning and think, this is it? This is the experience. No, you get in there and you know, you take your shower, you're grateful that there's water, you know, and you get out. So similarly, our devotees, they have an attitude towards their jobs and businesses in school. Yeah, it's like taking a shower. You do the necessary. It's for maintaining the body. They don't take it to be the essence of life. But for those who are not performing bhakti yoga, you have to take these things as the essence of life. Very serious. Your job. Your education. What more could there be than that? Who is it? I was talking to someone. I can't remember where it was. So many cities. I can't. I asked them, so, what does your mother, it was a devotee. I said, what does your mother feel about your studying in school, university? Somehow that topic came up, and the devotee said, my mother just advised me, whatever I do is all right, whatever I study at the uni is okay, but I have to have a passion for it. That's the main thing. When you have a passion for whatever you do, then you've achieved the supreme destination. This is as best parental advice as you'll get these days. Now, it doesn't matter what you do, but whatever you do, have a passion for it. Then your life is successful. If you're going to study geology with a passion. If you're going to have a lust affair with someone, make sure it's passionate. Whatever you do, it's got to be passion. That's the highest advice people can give these days. No question of controlling the senses. No. Just whatever you do, get into it fully and feel the passion. Create more passion. As for impediments, oh, there'll always be some problems in this world. But just like Gajendra, the elephant, just keep running through the thorns. Don't even pay them any attention. Why? What is in your vision? What is your goal? Gajendra had a goal, which made him oblivious to all the inconveniences. Do you see how that happens? Under the influence of illusory energy, when you have sense gratification as your goal of life, you are willing to tolerate. It's not that you just simply tolerate practicing Krishna consciousness. No. If you're going to live material life, you have to tolerate so many inconveniences. So many humiliations. But you minimize all that because in your mind is the vision of sense gratification. When I get home, what I'm going to do? Those of you who've had working experience and university experience, you can see what it's like if done from the mundane point of view. How many humiliations and embarrassments do you have to go through while you work and go to school? But in your mind, you're thinking, when I get home, I'm going to be doing this, I'm going to be doing that. Or on the weekend, it's going to be this, it's going to be that. If you're a materialist, you have to think like that. Of course, if you're a devotee, you're thinking, oh, as soon as I get out of here, I can finish my rounds. I might even be able to get some reading in tonight. I'll go to the temple. But if you're a materialist, what are you thinking? As soon as I get out of here, oh, when I get home, TV, you know, drugs, alcohol, illicit sex. Yeah, as soon as I get home. In fact, they can't wait to get home anymore. They try to do these things during the job. Is it true? Yeah, everyone does. That then the work becomes wonderful. So therefore, there's so many affairs going on at the job place. So many lusty affairs. And of course, that's half the reason, at least, for going to university. Who are you going to meet there? If you look at the moral standard of the university students today, you don't have to wonder much what the future of the nation will be. What does it mean to go to the uni today? How scantily can you dress? How much of a mobile red light district can you be? Then you're a successful student. How blasted and wasted can you become and still graduate? That's what it means to go to the uni these days. And you'll tolerate so many inconveniences to get your goal. But if we say, tolerate for Krishna's service, oh, it's too difficult. I don't know if I can do that. But tolerate for sense gratification? Well, of course. It's worth it. All right. So, Gajendra's running through the forest with his herd. And he's causing damage. He's breaking plants and creepers, thickets, and trees. He doesn't care, though. Why? He's got his vision in mind. He's going to get it. This is how we live in this world, materially. Yeah, look, you're going to have to hurt a few people, but don't go out of your way to do it. Don't do it intentionally, but you got to get what you got to get, you know? Everyone can understand that. I mean, you know, it's not that you're trying to hurt anybody, but you're just, you've got to do what you've got to do for yourself. And everybody can understand that. That's the way it's presented. So this is how we're doing, just like Gajendra. Wandering through the forest of material enjoyment, breaking plants, creepers, thickets, and trees, not caring for the thorns. I've got my goal, I've got my vision, and it's special and unique. That's how we bolster our ego. My vision is special, it's unique. It's very embarrassing for non-devotees when we point out that it's the same old thing that you're trying for. I don't like that. No, my lust affairs are special. My intoxication is special. My traveling is special. My family is special. Everything is special. And here we are saying, it's all the same thing. It's all stale. What do you mean? They think that we're being, how should we say, we're not seeing the full reality. Say the university is just, what do you mean? Each sense gratifier is unique and special. it's all sense gratification. No, how do you know? How can you say like that? That's immediately the response. How can you say like that? Do you know everybody there? They think that material nature is so special and so intricate. And we know that material nature is the same thing, very bland. But you have to think like that. You have to think that everything is special to protect your false ego. So there you are. You're like Gajendra the elephant, running through the forest, surrounded by your female elephants. You're breaking trees and plants. Don't worry, you've got to get what you've got to get. Thorns are pricking you, never mind, a little pain. No pain, no gain. And at the end of your journey, there'll be sense gratification waiting for you. Everything will be all right. Next verse. Simply by catching scent of that elephant, all the other elephants, the tigers, and the other ferocious animals, such as lions, rhinoceroses, great serpents, and black and white sarabas, fled in fear. The chamari deer also fled. Now, whatever you do in this world causes some problems for somebody else. Have you noticed that, materially speaking? And a truly sensitive person starts to notice that. What can I do in this world that doesn't cause problems for others? If I just go to the store and buy a rubber band, I've caused problems for some third world country where they, you know, I've got people working in sweatshops making rubber bands. What am I going to do? I can't even buy a rubber band without causing somebody pain. You notice what people do is they pick out one section of huge reality and try to be attentive in that one section or sector. I don't buy rubber bands because rubber bands come from oppressive labor conditions in the third world. They pick out one little slice and try to feel really good about that. I give money to the heart fund, or I give money to the cancer fund, and I don't buy these kind of products. In this way, they try to feel for themselves that they are being attentive and caring and considerate. But it's not possible to be attentive, caring, and considerate across the board in material life. And that is a dilemma that will affect any truly thinking person. How can I live so I don't cause others problems? A truly considerate person thinking like that. Arjuna thought like that in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. He was on the material plane in terms of his consciousness, and he was thinking. By Krishna's arrangement, it was like that. He's demonstrating for our benefit what it's like to be in material consciousness. So Arjuna was saying, how can I fight this war without causing problems? If I win, it'll be a problem. And if I lose, it'll be a problem. That's how a considerate person thinks. Similarly, a considerate person living material life is bewildered. What to do? Everything I try to do has some fault attached to it, or the possibility of causing some inconvenience to somebody, no matter what I do. Intelligent person thinks like that. Gajendra is racing through the forest and causing other animals to run away in fear. Gajendra is the king of the forest, the elephant. He's doing his thing, but by his doing his thing, others are displaced. Just like you could say, oh, my family is moving to a nice new apartment, nice new building of flats in the suburbs. But then you find out that in order for the developers to build those flats, they had to displace low-income people. Oh, no, we're not going to do that. We've got values, our family. We're not moving to a place where the developers have ousted, you know, low-income people. And then you feel good about yourself. We've got some scruples. We've got some sense of dignity. But can you apply those scruples to everything in life? No, you don't know. And after a while, you give up because you realize it's impossible. Whatever I do is going to cause somebody some problems. An intelligent person thinks like this. Okay, I won't use plastic bags because they pollute the environment. I'll just use paper bags. All right, that's one thing. What else? I won't buy eggs that are produced in, you know, factory conditions. I'll only buy free-ranging eggs. Is that what they call them?
Yes.
You keep trying to make adjustments. What about petroleum? Petrol. Every time I fill my car, I'm contributing to the Earth's demise. On and on the list goes. What are you going to do? I'll give you an example. Can you pull this out, please? Once I was in Byron Bay area, and I met someone, a traveler who I had met in New Zealand, and he invited me to visit his farm where he stayed. He didn't tell me what was going on the farm. So I just dropped by, and it turned out that all the spiritual people there were followers of this Osho or this Rajneesh, and they have, you know, regular principles. The regular principles are that whoever wants to have a lusty affair with you, you have to agree because it's all part of working it out. That's the regular principle. naturally, I didn't know what was going on there, and so after a few minutes or so, it obviously appeared that I wasn't aware of the Yuga Dharma. when you have people walking in front of you, winking their eye, and this and that, and after 10 minutes, you've only been there 10 minutes, and I'm just kind of looking at them like, And so after a while, they realize, he's not one of us, He's an outsider, They don't care how you're dressed or how you look. They figure everybody's got to be into what we're into. So then the person I knew began to explain to me the glories of the place. Under the instructions of this person, this leader, everybody engages with everybody else and just works it out, cleanses the lower self, and then automatically they rise to the high level. And he showed me the ecological glories of the place. Everything was natural. What do you call it? The toilet paper was recycled. The stationery's recycled. The letterhead's recycled. All the soaps and bath oils and, of course, the kitchen completely organic. The furniture made of environmentally friendly materials, local materials. The house, of course, was very ecologically sound. He went through a whole half-hour explanation about how there was so much living in harmony with nature. So then let's see, we got all adults here. Yes. So then I asked one of my usual questions. I said, if everything is organic and natural here, and according to your philosophy, everyone should be engaging in, affairs with everybody else in order to work it all out. I said, how come I don't see any children here? I said, children are the natural result of such an activity. So where are all the children? I said, obviously, if there's no children around, you must be adopting some, various artificial methods. Some kind of birth control method, which is certainly not a natural thing. You're relying on artificial substances, whatever you do. He looked at me. Are you kidding? No one here takes horrible things like pills and other devices like that. We are truly organic. We are truly natural. I said, how come there's no children around? No children. Who wants children? They just get in the way. We have all the ladies here sterilized. Yeah, he told me that with a straight face. We're natural. We're organic. So, this is a glaring example of the truth of material existence. You may try to find some dignity in this way and that way. You may try to be ecological this way and that way, but there's always some glaring area where there's enormous problems, discrepancies. That's what troubles an intelligent person about material life, and such persons come to Krishna consciousness. They realize, I can't win. I can't live a clean life in the material world. I'm always compromised somewhere, somehow. My principles that I make for myself are always broken, violated, some way, somehow. You just get overwhelmed by that understanding. I can't live a good life, even if I want to. That's the amazing thing. Even if you want to, you can't live a good life. What to speak about if you don't want to? The amazing thing is, even if you want to, you can't. Pressures at the workplace, pressures at the university. Oh, I have to do these things. I have to drink with the people. I have to go to the parties. The pressure is so great today that if you refuse to break the regular principles, people think you're strange. By the mercy of this elephant, animals like the foxes, wolves, buffaloes, bears, boars, gopuchas, porcupines, monkeys, rabbits, and the other deer, and many other small animals, loitered elsewhere in the forest. They were not afraid of him. And we read the purport. So, that shows you that not only will you cause pain to others in this world, regardless of what you do, similarly, you'll always benefit somebody. Just like the small animals, they're benefited by Gajendra's presence because Gajendra chases away all the other ferocious animals. So this is what it's like to live material life. You've got friends and enemies. You've got people who you're benefiting and you've got people who you're hurting. That's the way it'll always be. But then, what is the real benefit? Are you actually giving real benefit to someone? This is a question that also pops up in the mind of a devotional candidate. It brings you to Krishna consciousness, this kind of thinking. Am I really giving benefit to my family, friends, and society? It really shakes you up when you start realizing, I'm not giving any real benefit to anyone. What can I do for my husband, wife, or children? What can I do for my family? What can I do for this society? I'm not giving any benefit, but who are we trying to fool? This is the way we want people to think. This is reality. Then they can better appreciate Krishna consciousness. But as long as they think, I'm giving benefit, I'm helping, then that ego of material existence remains. But as soon as they start realizing, let's face it, what value am I really adding to my loved ones? What value am I really adding to society? What am I really doing for my kids or for my wife or husband? That's really beneficial. That's very good when they start thinking like that. And in the last verse we'll do today, we're hearing how Gajendra is surrounded by other elephants. And you're getting a picture of Gajendra in his pursuit of sense gratification. He's making the whole Trikuta mountain tremble because of the weight of his body. He's perspiring, liquor is dripping from his mouth, and his vision is overwhelmed by intoxication. Now, if this sounds like a typical person today on vacation, doesn't it? Walking around the beach feeling like you're making the whole beach tremble. You're perspiring, liquor dripping from your mouth. Your vision overwhelmed by intoxication. Of course, you're not being served by bumblebees who drink honey. And certainly from a distance, you don't smell the dust of lotus flowers, which is carried from the lake by the breeze. But that can be taken in another way. You see, Gajendra was pursuing a vision. He was pursuing a goal. The dust of the lotus flowers coming from the lake. I smell it. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Let's run for the lake and enjoy ourselves. His senses were stimulated by that vision. He had a goal in mind. The air is full of lotus flowers. Dust from the lake. Let's go. Let's go. So similarly, when you're pursuing sense gratification, you have a vision in mind. It's going to be like this. It's going to be like that. Let's go. Let's go. That's what keeps materialists going. And, of course, devotees have Krishna as their goal. The devotees want to smell the flavor from the Lord's lotus feet. Even impersonalists can become devotees in that way, like the four Kumaras, Tasnaravinda, Nayanasya, Padaravinda. They smelled the fragrance from the lotus flowers at the feet of the Lord, and they said, ah, let us give up our impersonal realization. Let us become devotees of the Lord. So you have to see which vision is motivating you, the spiritual or the material vision. If you're a materialist, you must be motivated simply by dreams of money and sex. That's all there is to do in material life. Can you find anything else that they do? After all is said and done, where's the money, where's the sex? And intoxication, because money and sex will frustrate you. The sex doesn't happen like the movies. After a while, people start to realize that. If it did, why aren't the movie stars in ecstasy all the time? They're the most miserable people. But when they get on the movie screen, they're paid to show you that you'll find complete fulfillment in lusty affairs. Not like that. Everyone has to have some vision. So check yourself out. What is your vision in life? What's motivating you? Generally, it's very embarrassing to think about if you're a non-devotee. What's my vision? What's motivating me? Oh. People don't even want to think about it because it's too embarrassing. As devotees, we're happy to think about what is our vision, what's motivating us, what's pushing us forward. It's the all-attractive Krishna, Krishna's service. The taste of Krishna's service becomes so relishable. It's our natural position to render service to Krishna's senses. What pushes us further? The desire to become better at pleasing Krishna's senses. So everyone is motivated by a vision. But the devotee's vision is, let me use my life for giving more pleasure to Krishna. Krishna's pleasure is my pleasure. So what do you smell from a distance? In other words, what is pushing you on? Gajendra is far from the lake, but he smells the air filled with lotus particles from the lake. He continues, therefore, crashing his way through the forest. So what do we smell? It's making us crash through life to get to that goal. You can ask yourself that question. What is it that you're hoping for at the end of the day? What is it that you're hoping for at the end of the decade or at the end of your life? Sometimes people find it very scary to think about these things. Or else they say, "Ah, I'll worry about that later when I'm old. Right now, let the good times roll." There's money to be had, parties to be attended, sense gratification to be experienced. Just do that now and think later. You are having a goal, though. These gross things are your goal. Now, in Krishna consciousness, it's not that we have no goals. We have no vision. No. The goals and vision change. To the fragrance from Krishna's lotus feet, to see Krishna smile, to hear Krishna's words, to see Krishna standing in his threefold bending form. We've replaced the material sense objects with the spiritual sense objects. Venam kanantam aravinda tvairaksham bahavatam samasitam buddhasundarangam Kandarpa Koti Kamaniya Vishesha Shobham Govinda Mahadi Purusham Tamamajami. We want to see those eyes like blooming lotus petals. We want to hear the flute. We want to see that threefold bending form of Sham Sundar. We want to hear the glories of the Lord. We want to hear the Hare Krishna mantra. We want to taste the prasad that's offered to the Lord. You want to rub shoulders with the Lord's devotees. So this is our aspiration. Any questions?
You were saying that females, people, see that even devoted families often have trouble when their children get to their teenage years. But from my experience, it seems that their peers seem to influence them a lot. And their peers are more or less pumped with all this media that says nonsense is cool. How are parents supposed to deal with it?
But it's true that often teenage children of devotees go through an intense period. But the parents just don't dismiss it, saying, well, everyone's doing like that, what can we do? The parents try, because the parents have their duty to Krishna to try regardless of the result. All you can do is your duty. But it's not that the Krishna conscious parents abdicate their duty. Ah, all the kids are doing like that, so... Yeah. No need for me to preach to my kid. What's the use? No, the parents do everything within their power and then leave the rest up to Krishna. And a proper parent does that. But the common attitude amongst non-devotees these days is, the kids are going to do it anyway, so just go with the flow. As long as they're happy some kind of way and don't cause too much trouble while they're running around in the forest of material enjoyment. Don't step on too many people.
We come and heard in that regard, sometimes they think it's better they do it at home with us rather than go out where we can't see them. So they buy the beer and they buy the alcohol and they have all the friends over with the teenage kid at their house. And they do the same thing, but the parents are there with them.
Yes. This is how they try to get some kind of, try to salvage some kind of dignity. My kid doesn't wander around the town doing those things. My kid does it at home. This is how ridiculous things are. And you can see the natural human tendency to try to salvage some dignity for yourself. My kid's not like that. My kid does all these things at home. We're loving, caring parents. You know the joke about it's 11 o'clock and do you know where your children are? Well, yeah, now they feel, huh?
Pass out on the couch.
Well, but he's passed out on the couch in our home. We know where he is. He's with his girlfriend in his room. We're doing our job as parents. So devotee parents, they may have difficulties with their children, but they don't dismiss the whole thing as, it doesn't matter, everyone's doing like that, he has to find his own way. No, if they're actually proper parents, they try their best. Just like a preacher, you have to preach the truth. And sometimes you don't know what the result will be. You do it out of duty, out of love. So that's the difference between devotees raising children and having some difficulties and non-devotees raising children. The devotees know what the goal is. So it's sometimes very difficult. Well, should we have a television? Because if we don't have a TV at home, the kids think it's weird, and they'll just go away from home. If we have a TV at home, the kids will watch it. You know, it's nonsense, but at least they're at home, and we don't want to be too severe with them. Each family has a different response to this, but it's difficult. I'm sure you know here in Perth, different Grihastha families will have their different visions. No TV in my house. I don't care what my, kid thinks. Other families, devotee families, well, we don't want a TV, but look, we've got to keep our kids, peaceful and in the hopes that gradually we can preach to them. So But regardless of the approach, everyone, devotees, have the same goal. We do want our kids to get through this rebellious stage in one piece, one way or another. Maybe the details differ, but the goal is the same. They don't just abdicate their responsibilities. Ah, everyone's doing like that, you know. Let the kids find their own way. Hey, ladies, questions? Yes?
I can see that sometimes, like, some non-devotees, like, I've been home from homeschool, lots of the children actually, they turn out very, very nicely, even compared to other children. I've been with girls in Tasmania, where there's one family that's just starting to get a parent in addition to consciousness. And she young girls have been homeschooled, like, you know, there's apparently a quite big movement in Tasmania, and she's, you know, like, on very different bases. And in many ways, the children are morally more clear. I mean, these young girls, in their early teens, are kind of seem much clearer, much purer than actually any group of women I've ever come across. So if I could just see...
What do you mean by pure?
Well, I mean, they were brought up nicely, basically. You know, morally, they were... Yeah, they didn't have television. They were exposed to materialistic society at life at large. I mean, I don't know, but they were very beginning to my youth, but they were...
Wait a minute. You're confusing two different things. You're talking about persons, children who are being homeschooled in Tasmania.
Well, and in general, you know, just people who are, you know, like, say, leading like a mode of goodness lifestyle.
But who's leading a mode of goodness lifestyle? A mode of... You read Bhagavad Gita Standard, a mode of goodness? Have you read chapter 14, what it says about the mode of goodness? And then you're going to tell me you've met many, listen, you've met many mode of goodness people? Wait a minute. I can only deal with one point at a time. You're hitting me with about 10 things at once. Have you read chapter 14 of Bhagavad Gita?
I have.
Do you remember what Krishna says is the standard for mode of goodness? I can understand that. All the senses of the body are illumined by knowledge. All the senses are under control.
Well, I mean,
what you basically are saying is you've met some peaceful persons in the mode of passion. That's basically what you're saying.
I kind of keep the scriptural references or anything, but sometimes it does seem, you know, like such people who exist, just like, you know, people who are living close to nature, who are...
The animals are also living close to nature.
You know, who are vegetarian, etc.
What did Prabhupada always say? The monkeys? What, monkeys? Or what animal? Pigeons are vegetarians.
Some ways they seem more,
Where is the inclination toward Krishna's service?
Well, perhaps people, I think, you know, they're more inclined in many cases to, you know.
Well, then they should do it. They should take up devotional service. Then we give credit. How can you see lasting or significant value without Krishna's service? That is my question.
Well, there is none.
You said it, not me. The fallacy of this kind of presentation is thinking that, you know, the so-called organic sense gratification is the mode of goodness. It's not. It's just the upper level of the mode of passion. We have a real Kali Yuga cheap vision of what the mode of goodness is. She's not giving up. I know I'm shattering all your hopes. Were they nicer than? Listen, were they nicer than your daughter?
In some ways, a little fellow more peaceful, and they were very much more, I mean, these young girls were charities, they were, but, you know, like, because they're upbringing, you know, they were, and if I remember when I was living down there preaching, we met many family classes, you know, like,
Were they as nice as your daughter?
I mean, I'm
my Lord. I think your daughter is very spiritually inclined. Here's the mistake that's being made. You're just seeing a tiny section of their life. You can't see, let's say, 10 years. Just like with your daughter. Okay, right now she may be a certain way at this point in time, but if we look over a period of 10 years, we see that your daughter is the most fortunate. But often what happens is devotees, you know, they see something and they just trip out about it. Oh, look at these children. These children are nicer than my children. But you have not lived with those children over a period of 10 years.
Wait, listen.
You got to make one point and stick to it. What is your point? What's the gut thing in your heart you're feeling that you're not eloquently expressing?
So
what is your point?
So we see that not some non-devotees, their parents are chained to each other for a lifetime. The parents, you know, like the children aren't subjected to the trash.
Okay, let me stop you there. Some are like that. And also, many devotee families are like that too, even when seen from the material point of view. Right? It's not that every devotee family breaks. Your family's not breaking. Sujirani's family hasn't broken. So why is it that all devotee families... wait, hold on. So some devotee families, quite a few are intact. And some non-devotee families are intact. Yes? Okay. And now what? Right. Right. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
What is the point you're trying to make? Does anyone know Sujirani? Can you explain her point, please?
I know her point. I think it's that she's saying that the TV is like the condition of the material world. The TV, and the kids are watching the TV, so they're conditioned to the material attitudes. Whereas people that's not watching TV are more free from that conditioning, that heavier conditioning. That's one point.
Just by not watching TV, you're free from conditioning. Got all these commentators.
Everyone wants to live there. It's peaceful and simple. The trees are there, and chop them all down yet. And when I go down there, I see the way they live. And, you know, there's just the clarity because they're away from the city. Just the natural setting. Seems like they're more peacefully minded. Their kids are more sort of respectful and there's more clarity. And myself also think, I'd like to live like this. You know, sort of like, and then I come back to the temple here. And temporarily when I'm down there, I feel like, well, I just want to be a devotee down here. And all the devotees come down here were so nice and peaceful. But then I come back to the temple and, you know, in this city, passion against whatever. They don't like that, and that's in the community, because we're in the city. But after a while, you know, you just appreciate the ladies, and you don't want to be anywhere else, kind of thing. I'm not saying that's what you're saying, but that's my. I can understand what point she's trying to make. Because also I think the same thing about my family that lives down here. How they seem so peaceful and simple and mode of goodness.
Mode of goodness again, huh?
They seem that way.
So therefore I say you don't understand material nature. How it works. There's, of course, nothing wrong with our devotee families wanting to live a peaceful life. Actually, to tell you the truth, there's really no reason why devotee families should stay in a city except to preach. But since we don't have much of an alternative for various reasons, therefore our devotee families are in the city, also by their own choice. Often they like the conveniences of the city in spite of the disturbances. But Prabhupada's idea was that devotee families who are not preaching should not be in the city. The suburban Krishna consciousness, no matter what you want to say about it, was not Prabhupada's idea. So I'm not attacking the suburban Krishna conscious lifestyle right now. I'm just saying it wasn't Prabhupada's idea. Prabhupada's idea was that for families who live in the city, they're involved in preaching. Otherwise, why be in the city? But it so turned out that many Krishna conscious families, for one reason or another, feel comfortable in the city. But there's nothing wrong with our families desiring a more peaceful life. But what they shouldn't do is make a mistake of seeing peace in material nature. That is a big mistake. As you said, apparently it seems that way. It seems like they're peaceful. It's not so. You can't have peace within passion and ignorance. And they're not living according to goodness. If you look over a period of more years than what you're looking at, you'll see what's going on. Things can be shattered very quickly. It's a very precarious existence. You have to understand how material nature operates. And what's to say? Who's to say what their children will be like in the future? At least even a devotee child from a dysfunctional home has the hope of one day picking up devotional service again. Whatever service they've done, that's their eternal credit. But you get no eternal credits from being peaceful in material nature. All right, you get some... Sujirani, can you explain her point? Right, can someone explain her point? Oh.
I think what she's trying to say...
Okay, be careful of that.
My understanding of the point is you can say, what is the mode of goodness? But then again, you can say, what is a devotee? And looking at devoted families, for example, I've lived with devoted families, I've seen devoted kids on a rafi after cart smoking drugs and drinking alcohol, going on as well. I think the point she's making is, how come they're more peaceful? How come they're more respectful to other people? And it seems to be within devotee in general, when speaking in general, like all people that go to university or going there for a passion, what she's trying to say is she's asking for help on how can she control her own family, I feel. But I can't get that book her to agree with that action idea now. But I think that's what she's crying out for help. And now she seems to be hurt by that.
I don't know. But here's the thing. You can't just pick out certain elements, like, okay, ex-devotee's child was on the Roth cart smoking. Is that true?
That is true.
All right. But, okay. That is one bad aspect. But there are so many other fortunate aspects. So we tend to ignore the fortunate aspects, and these fortunate aspects in their lives are eternal aspects. And even in spite of some temporary problems, some of those kids you saw, who can say what great things they may do in the future?
Absolutely. And some of these other people that are in
Tasmania. Wait a minute. I'm not talking about persons in Tasmania who are chanting. I'm talking about persons who appear to be peaceful, but who have no contact with devotional service. What is their future hope? So you have to look not only at the immediate, you have to look at the long range too. Otherwise you can tend to get bewildered by the statements in Shastra. What? They're very strong, very heavy. But you have to be able to look at the whole span of life, the next life, the previous life too. So what appears to be peaceful now, when viewed from a wider vision, can appear to be very problematic. So we can't just get rattled so much just because I saw this devotee's kid do this or I saw this devotee's kid do that. Whereas the kids of non-devotees, they look peaceful and more, whatever, wholesome. What is the point of being wholesome and peaceful within material nature? Without any transcendental assets. Better to have some transcendental assets. Temporarily, your situation may look peaceful, but it cannot last that way. It's not what material nature is asking of you. By that I mean, if you're going to survive in material nature, you've got to develop something more than a semblance of peace.
Absolutely. When you come to peace, they can go further as well. Sometimes the children are actually more towards the moment when it's trying to elevate the family, trying to bring them more to spiritual life, then it's good, yes?
If the family is trying to bring the kids to Krishna consciousness, that's the best thing.
That's good. So the kids are in that, well, the parents have brought them up correctly, and now they're coming to Krishna consciousness, they're able to be more sober and listen to the truth. And
however it happens, if they come to Krishna consciousness, that is the best thing. Yeah. However, the value is there when they come in contact with bhakti yoga. Otherwise, it gets very, you're really grasping for straws trying to find value in non-devotional situations. Because the Kali Yuga is so turbulent.
Maybe another example is like you're a transcendentalist, so if you're in a pub, it's going to be hard to preach to people in the pub, but if you're at the Sunday feast, you're going to get more reciprocating people in an environmental centre. People are going to be listening more because they're more...
I haven't found that to be true. I haven't found it. I have found that you just don't know. You could be preaching to people who are so-called down and out in the mode of ignorance and passion, and they're desperate, they want to hear about Krishna, and you can be preaching to New Agers who are simply organic sense gratification, and they're the hardest people in the world to get them to take up devotional service, because they know everything. And you're being dogmatic, sectarian. The Bhagavad Gita is a dogma book, and just let everybody do what they feel, and that's the best thing for their health, and don't try to hurt anybody, and whatever you want to believe is okay. Those are the hardest people. Just go to the Conscious Living Festival and try to preach.
You can't say they're the hardest because even within them, because you can say you never know. As you just said.
No, I'm just pointing out that it's not automatic that such people are so easily come to Krishna consciousness. In fact, those, and from my experience, those are the most difficult people. Whereas someone who's down and out and fried on material existence, often they are more easy to preach to than someone who has an artificial sense of contentment and peace within material nature. You understand what I'm saying?
I'm just trying to relate it to the children.
It depends what you're talking about, whether devotee children or non-devotee children. Obviously, children who are starting to chant Hare Krishna, they are very fortunate. But without that, even they're raised nicely by their parents, sooner or later material nature in this most intense portion of Kali Yuga takes its effect on them. Okay, you can say Kali Yuga is affecting devotee children too, but they have some future hope and they have eternal credits in their bank account.
But then he had gone to that desert storm war in America. And he was in a tank and he fell asleep. He was supposed to stay awake. And then he totally forgot about Krishna consciousness. But when the bombs were coming, he just immediately remembered Krishna and was chanting. And then after the war,
he came back and he said he went right to the temple and he just was, you know, he was really like grateful that, you know, he'd been devoted before. So maybe, you know, and obviously that was, he went away from Krishna consciousness, but because he had it in the beginning, now, you know, it just came out by that.
That's why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Swapam Apyasa Dharmasya Tate Matobaya. On this path, there's no diminution. In other words, whatever you do, just like whatever you did, will be your eternal credit. Better you've done that than nothing and live a so-called material life of peace. It's a little difficult to understand, I know.
I'm not promoting you should live a life of peace, but I'm saying better be peaceful because they're closer to becoming the next step to Krishna consciousness. The goal is not to become peaceful, the goal is to become Krishna conscious. But better to be someone with children that are peaceful, that are listening, that you say... Better to have children that listen than children that are out stealing cars and don't listen to their parents. I think that's the message that we're bringing across.
I think she's saying something different. Right? I don't think it was...
Over the years, I kind of devoted kids.
You guys like to have discussions here, I notice. Yeah?
I have to agree with her too. That
what was she saying? First of all,
she was saying,
okay, let's hear from the Mataji's, a mother with a child.
Actually, I have a feeling that Shashini's point wasn't, as she said, that she denies that devoted children ultimately are more fortunate in that regard. She feels put off when materialists are presented as only being an extreme degrading case. That's what she was trying to counteract. I remember in previous class in which she had described many devotees coming from very degraded backgrounds. And she mentioned to me that she felt embarrassed when others, say Indian families or so-called, hear that description, that they conclude that all the devotees must have come from very degraded backgrounds. So I think she was probably trying to counter rather the depiction of materialists as always extremely degraded, trying to say that actually some materialists are not that degraded. So the point that you're making that, of course, degraded or not degraded, they're not transmitted, she would have said.
And also, I was making a further point that it's not the mode of goodness, it's the higher point levels of the mode of passion. So therefore, if you want good material life, you don't find it these days. That's my point. So I'm not simply speaking that, you know, either transcendental or forget it. I'm pointing out that what we see today, even at best, is not the mode of goodness. But that's a difficult point for devotees to understand because many of them want to see something there. And here I am saying, there's no mode of goodness out there. So I'm not simply saying transcendental or bust. I'm saying, look, if you want the mode of goodness, still you don't find that. The standards of mode of goodness are given in the 14th chapter. You don't find that. Okay, you find vegetarians or you find people with stable family life, but you don't find the mode of goodness. So I'm not willing to give credit where credit's not due. If you start talking to people, which I do all the time, you find out amazing things. But unless you talk to them, you don't find out. The truly horrible things that are going on in their lives and their associates. Once you pull back the curtain, it's like that's the good thing about Sankirtan. Once you start talking to people and hearing what they're going through and what their families are going through, you realize there's only an appearance of peace. But you have to talk to people to find that out, because otherwise they won't tell you. Because the way you live material life is to put up a front. And once you go beyond the front, things are a bit difficult.
Devotees do, they also put up a front too, you know? And the devotees who are chanting Hare Krishna, they can be chanting for many lifetimes. I mean, I don't know exactly where...
Many lifetimes!
Like I said, for thousands of years you can chant Hare Krishna, but you mightn't get the full effect or the full benefit. And you can also, in one moment, you can become Krishna conscious.
So what is your point?
So these people that are coming from so-called Motor Goodness backgrounds, that, you know, they can be given the holy name just on the
last... Oh, yes!
The last year of the... I mean, we can't... You say, look, where devotees are going to be in 50 years, but we don't know where these people are going to be in 50 years anyway.
I missed your point.
I missed my point? Well, I thought it was pretty clear. But what I'm saying is that you judge devotees to say, well, this devotee's chanting Hare Krishna, and he might come back to the movement, and he might be, you know, a great transcendentalist, or a great whatever. But this person too, that's not chanting Hare Krishna, you know, within one moment, they can also become Krishna conscious through the mercy of Guru and through the mercy of...
So we give the credit not to material nature. Listen. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Now you listen. Yes, we can. We give the credit to Krishna and Krishna's devotee for intervening into material nature. We don't give the credit to material nature. And if there was mode of goodness, we would give credit to mode of goodness. But there's no mode of goodness. Therefore, I speak the way I'm speaking, because there's no mode of goodness. That is my point. That may be, but the point is, if there was a mode of goodness today, I'd give some credit. But I speak the way I do because there's not even mode of goodness. That's why it seems a little heavy. If there was a mode of goodness, truly, I'd give credit. But it's not there.
And then there's high degrees of passion.
Right, exactly what I said. What you find is the top of the mode of passion at best. So that's why I speak the way I do. Because there's no mode of goodness. You're being very charitable to say the three modes of nature. You don't see that in terms of people being fully in the mode of goodness. The effect of the mode of goodness will be there. Here's an example. After a war, people start thinking, it's not worth it, these wars. Let's try to live peacefully. That is an effect of the mode of goodness, contemplation. But it doesn't mean they're living in the mode of goodness. You understand? Yes, because the three modes are affecting the world. But just because there's a mode of goodness effect doesn't mean that the people are living in the mode of goodness. It's all mixed. So I speak the way I do because there's no mode of goodness. If there was actually mode of goodness completely, someone's living in mode of goodness, I'd give credit. But I'm making a difficult point, because it's not that. There's no mode of goodness, people, practically speaking. You have passionate ignorance. And we're not going to give credit for passionate ignorance. So if you see that perspective, maybe it's easier to understand. But the natural tendency is to try to see some value in material nature, even when there's no mode of goodness, people. I don't do that. Naturally, you get a little defensive. I'm pushing it a bit, I know. And I know what I'm talking about. I talk to university students. I know what goes on in universities. I talk to families. I know what goes on in their families. I go all over the world. I actually talk to people and hear from their lives. Yes?
When you say that, if somebody reacts and says, that may be true, most people are like that, but it doesn't mean every university student is like that. I think that's pretty much all that's going on here, that people are saying, well, maybe somebody who's not having a successful intoxication and they're at university.
Then they're doing something else.
That's another point.
There may be someone who's not having illicit sex at university, not taking intoxication, but they're doing something else.
Less degraded, but not
Krishna conscious. Less degraded. Yeah. Right. Right.
But I'm just saying that the reaction comes in. When you make a statement like that, and then they think, oh, but not everyone's that degraded. That's all.
I like the way you said that. Not everyone's that degraded. That's very eloquently put. Yes, that's a good way. Not everyone's that degraded. I agree. Not everyone is that degraded. Generally, they only have one girlfriend, if they're mode of goodness. But I'm not... I'm not laughing at them. I'm commenting on the effects of associating with material nature. Did you ever that word ever come out of my mouth that no devotees have faults? Did I ever say that? Yes, it is them and us. You're right. Thank you. It is them and us. Yes, it is them and us.
For example, my class, they were vegans and vegetarians. One was an atheist, but now they've both got proper on a little altar. They're doing a little bit of offering.
Wonderful.
Or look at them and us, I saw them as equal. I saw them actually better than me because they're doing some good. They actually started helping animals. I actually saw them better than myself and saw that they're just missing Krishna. That's all.
That's nice. That's nice. But what makes you think that the Krishna conscious preacher doesn't see the people as better than him? Actually, what the devotee thinks is that I am fortunate because I have Krishna. If you will take up devotional service, you'll be far better than me. That's what a devotee preacher thinks. We say what Krishna says. Well, you're entitled to see what you want to see, but I'm speaking Bhagavad Gita. That is the. You can see what you want, but I'm speaking Bhagavad Gita. Now, what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Namam duskatino mudha pupajante naradama. If they don't surrender to Krishna, they have to be in four categories. Now, personally, I may think they're nice people, but Krishna has said, what can I do? Now, I didn't say that every devotee strictly follows Bhagavad Gita, but I'm preaching the standard of Bhagavad Gita. That is the point. What Krishna says, I say. And I have found it to be true. As Sukhirani is saying, you'll find people who aren't that degraded. That's as best as it's going to get these days. It's tragic. I know. I've thought about this very deeply. Would you consider that a fair statement?
It's a generalization.
Yes. But, yes, from much talking to many people. You're not going to find... It'll be very rare to find celibate university students.
I'm speaking to a gentleman named Andrew Knight. Now, he's practicing celibacy at the moment. Mm-hmm. And he's introduced animals that they can now test, plastic animals, rather than killing animals in the university. Mm-hmm. He's now introducing that into secondary education, and he risks losing his university degree in what he believed in was his treatment to animals. Now, he's got some kind of maybe higher level of ignorance in him to do that, and he's trying to do some good, but he doesn't know any better. He needs Krishna in his life, that's all.
Yes, he needs Krishna in his life.
He's trying to do good. I don't know where he's come from. He's a great soul in his last life as a devotee, but in this life he hasn't got the title or the address. He's not wearing tilak to say he is a devotee. I don't know what's in his heart.
Look, why don't you go to university and find how many people are practicing celibacy? Mm-hmm. I talk to many students all over the world.
I can say how many people in this time practicing celibacy
too. There is a significant number. Now, why always jump to that? That's right. Yes, But why, when you talk about whether there is celibacy or not at the university, then immediately you jump back to devotees? Let's just focus on one side or the other, because they're dealing, even a fallen devotee is different from a non-devotee.
But that's the big question. How do you know they're not a non-devotee?
When they manifest devotional service, then we classify them as devotees.
Absolutely.
So how many people do you know who are celibate at university?
I don't know how many people know that are celibate.
Right. An exception we'll give credit to. But generally, and you can only speak generally, yeah. Yes, I am making generalizations. Generally, it is so. Everyone at a university, at best, the best is just have one steady girlfriend, one steady boyfriend for some years.
There's a lot of people going back to university level now.
I'm talking about younger ones. That's as best as it gets, generally speaking. There are exceptions, of course. So therefore, it's not that degraded. But when you look at the standard of mode of goodness, it falls far short. So therefore, as I say, you pick out various aspects. Well, this is good, or that is good. That doesn't mean mode of goodness, though. The standard of Bhagavad Gita is very strict. That is a problem. I acknowledge that. But I'm duty-bound to present Bhagavad Gita. I don't make any pretenses to anything else. And I think it can be observed that the process of material nature is very deadly these days. Therefore, devotees have problems, people coming to Krishna consciousness have problems, because the material energy is so intense these days. Now, if you ask me personally, I am outraged at how materialistic society destroys people's opportunities for any kind of higher thinking. I'm outraged at that. Breaks my heart to see that material nature is not getting more elevated. Things are becoming more degraded. That breaks my heart. And yes, almost always material life is as I've described it. Almost always. Yes, there are exceptions, but as they say, the exceptions prove the general rule. Anyone who adds just a little bit of Krishna consciousness to their life is automatically much more fortunate. Whatever you two do, automatically you're much more fortunate than anybody because of your involvement with Bhakti Yoga. Even if you walk out the door here and never do anything in devotional service again in this lifetime, you are much more fortunate than anybody else in the general population. So that's the standard I'm preaching from. The exclusiveness of devotional service. And I would acknowledge the mode of goodness if it was there. But I'm speaking like that because it's not there. Nor do I want devotees to look askance at their extraordinary opportunity to render devotional service, thinking that there is some value in a mode of passion and ignorance society. So that's why I'm a bit stubborn. It's also protective. It's done out of love. I'm not going to let you, on my watch, see something in material nature that's not there, because it's not good for you. Just like a parent who will not allow the children to see something as real that's not real. It's very hazardous for the development. I'm sure you've all had examples of when you were a kid, you saw something you wanted and your parents said no, and you got very angry because you were sure. I can give my own examples. I was 14. There was some girl I was interested in. I was sure it would be heavenly. And my mother said, no, she's not the one for you. And my mother did all sorts of things to keep this girl away from me. And I was really angry at the time. 3 years later, I thanked her. But at the time, I was very angry. How could you say this? How can you dismiss her like that? There are different levels of vision. So you can't expect me maybe to agree with your vision completely. I don't think you came here for that. Maybe there's some value in what I'm saying. Yes.
Well, definitely agree with you in many points, Raj.
But.
I appreciate the conversation.
One at a time, please.
Just within devotional service, it's true that there's different. You can also chant in the mode of passion, goodness, and ignorance.
Still, you're chanting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always chanting in the mode of passion.
I'm glad you're still chanting.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. What does Lord Chaitanya say? How do you know who's the best among people? Who knows the verse? Whoever chants Hare Krishna once is the best.
I wouldn't say I'm the best, but you know. I think it's really cool. But it's a some way that we can, at least I can, improve my chanting to a mode of goodness standard.
Yes. Come to the temple and chant your japa. You live nearby? It's a very nice question. Yeah. Come to the temple and chant your japa in the temple of the devotees. Yeah. And also chant your rounds in the morning. Maybe hard because you work, right?
Yeah.
Well, as much as you can, chant your japa in the morning and chant your japa in the temple and with devotees. Then you'll see things will become better. That's a very nice question. Now, what didn't you agree about? You said most things I said you...
Oh, yeah. I guess I'll just go my own point of view.
No, but what thing? What thing?
I don't know. So.
All right, afterwards you can tell me. Afterwards you can tell me. Now, what thing didn't you agree about?
Myself.
Yes.
You were asking, does anyone have an opinion on what Mother Charles was saying? My opinion.
I don't know if that's what she meant, but
that's
yeah. Okay, well, she has right to talk, huh? You guys come here every day? They come to class every day? I see, so it's all just coming out now. Well, I'm very liberal and charitable, aren't I? So I'll talk to Mother Charshni afterwards. And what did you say you felt her point was? That.
Just to counterbalance the presentation that was shown the most negative side.
Most? I have a disagreement with that. I'm probably being very liberal and very charitable. I know. I talk to people all the time. I have things what they're going through. I'm being very liberal. Very charitable. But I'm objecting to this process of, well, I know one person who... Okay, that's the exception. You go out on Sankirtan every day, you'll see all these things. You'll see that the exceptions are just that, exceptions. I've been through the whole New Age thing, you know, in terms of, oh, these people maybe have some special receptivity. And I found it's harder preaching to those people than anybody else. Because they know everything. It's hard to cure someone who thinks they're healthy. Not to say it's impossible that anybody can come from those circumstances, but in general it's tough. You're going to the conscious living. Yes, we give them prasad. They pay for it. So you come here more often and you'll become more Krishnatized. It's natural that if you're away from here, your consciousness will change. It's natural. And it seems a bit fierce sometimes what we're saying here. But I'm preaching Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, if you don't surrender to him, you have to be in one of four categories, even impersonalist Mayavadis, who are certainly austere and certainly in the mode of goodness. Even Mayavadi sannyasis are included by Krishna in the Duskritino category, without merit. This is how glorious bhakti is. Even those who spend their whole life practicing severe austerities and penances in India and have reached the conclusion that we all are Brahman, we all are the Supreme. Krishna puts them into the category of miscreants. Why? Because no surrender to Krishna. Now, to understand how this is not being dogmatic, you have to understand something about the glories of surrender to Krishna. Yeah. So I think that's what you have to add to your perspective once again. What are the glories of surrender to Krishna and devotional service? Otherwise, it will seem like we're being fanatical and a bit, you know. All right, so they don't do any service, but still. If you understand the glories of surrender to Krishna and devotional service, then you'll see why we speak like this. But if you don't understand it, it does seem dogmatic, fanatical, us and them, this and that, the other, so on and so on. Us and them is in reference to, are you in contact with devotional service or not? It's not meaning, are you a name-carrying Hare Krishna? I never say anything like that. You understand? I never, you know, oh, are you wearing your neck beads? Hari Bol, you're okay. You're saved. In fact, if you come to enough classes, you'll see that I do speak out against that quite often, as everyone here knows. So, it's not like that, just to be an official card-carrying Hare Krishna. It's about rendering devotional service. That's the make it or break it point. Can you see a bit clearer now? I think what you're objecting to is the card-carrying Hare Krishnas. I'm not talking about whether they're carrying a card or not. I'm talking about who renders devotional service.
I think it's more that, I think just because you're chanting Hare Krishna doesn't mean that you can't be in the ignorance and passion. And that you see that a lot of kids, and wait, another chastening, a lot of kids, you know, that you can say they're very much, okay, they're chanting Hare Krishna, and I definitely agree with that point. They're most fortunate just because they're chanting Hare Krishna, but there's definitely room for improvement.
Oh, yes. Yes, there's room for improvement. There's room for improvement in all of us.
This wasn't just very sad, just like Centrelink. This is a very sad story. It's at Centrelink, and there's a crazy girl in the queue, and she's doing all weird things, and she kept coming up and talking to me and so on and so forth, and talking to everybody in Centrelink and dancing and causing a bit of a riot. And then eventually I pulled her over, because she looked like she wanted someone to talk to her. So I pulled her over and I said, "What's your name?" And she said, "It's Kali." And I said, "That's a nice name." She said, "You know, Kali like what?" She said, "Like Kali Yuga." And actually she's a devotee child that has fallen away, and the trauma that she's been through rape, through this, through that, and she's like a very lost soul at the moment. Unfortunately I didn't get her number because I called her away, but she had been away for a long time, and she it was just very sad to see her in this state. And she sort of noticed some neck beads that I've been wearing recently, and that way she started talking to me about, you know, her father and her uncle and family.
So, if you really want to help such people, then you become qualified to help them.
Her parents dropped her up north, up in the
road. But what did I just say?
And they made her walk back. They made her walk back because she wasn't following her Krishna conscious path properly. They dropped her, that's how she got raped. They dropped her and made her walk back so she was all on her own so she could get her thoughts together. But she's actually turned into a mental case now.
So you... If you want to help her, then you become qualified in Krishna consciousness to help such persons and to prevent such things from happening. If you want to help, you've got to pay a price. You've got to become qualified. Otherwise, all this will just go on and on and on. We can talk about it, but what is the use? You become qualified to help.
So I think Mother Chastity was saying there with that, like, that child, is how do we stop them getting there? She's crying out help, she's not challenging, she's not fighting, we're not fighting, we're not saying who's right and who's wrong.
I don't know if you know what Mother Chastity is talking about, but I can respond to what you're saying. I'm saying if you really feel compassion, then become qualified to help. Otherwise, it's very easy just to, well, this one and that one, you can go on and on like that. You do something about it. Try a bit harder. We all can try a bit harder. But yeah, but you try harder if you really care. If you care, you've got to pay the price. Otherwise, it's not real care. If you really want to help someone, you pay the price to help them. Otherwise, you don't really care. If you're not willing to come to the standard for helping, it means you really don't care. Anybody can make some passing comment. If I just sit up here and say the materialist, and I'm not doing anything about it, then, yeah, you have a right to get on my case. So if you really care, then help the people. Become qualified to help. Pay the price to help them. Otherwise, we can comment eternally. I know one person who, and give a great example. I know another person and give a, like, just example like you just gave. You can go on and on like that. But what is the point?
Training is not from.
All right, everything's calm now. I'll stick it out to the end of the match. Well, I have to catch up with Karshi, though. She didn't stick it right out to the end of the to the final quarter. Oh. All right, all glories to the Prabhupada. Very well.
Krishna.